This is the Right Honorable Noraleen Nash, the Buzzkill Institute's first female ambassador to California, welcoming you to hear my Uncle Phil busting myths and taking names today on Professor Buzzkill.
Well, 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 Buzzkillers, there's nothing but controversy here in the Buzzkill Institute. We did a show a few months ago, about the National Rifle Association. We got tons of hate mail, including people always screaming that the first thing Hitler did was to take away people's guns. And that's why they should be constitutionally guaranteed and all that sort of stuff. And I started to think about it, and I thought, well, the perfect person to ask about this is, of course, your favorite buzzkiller, Professor Philip Nash from Penn State, who's on the line courtesy of the internet. Professor, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. And by the way, before I forget, I should also add this quotation. This is from 2015.
Okay.
Ben Carson said, and I'm quoting, "I think the likelihood of Hitler being able to accomplish his goals would have been greatly diminished if the people had been armed."
So Ben Carson, that famous historian of World War II?
Right, exactly. Expert on the Third Reich, exactly.
Ben Carson, by the way, for non-American buzzkillers, is a doctor who is in some sort of position in the Trump administration.
He's the HUD secretary.
Oh, Health and Human Right. Housing and Urban Development.
Housing and Human the U.S. historian should know this. Yes, Housing and Urban Development.
Yeah, so as you can see, he's studied the 1940s extensively. But anyway, so when you and I were talking about this show, we thought the best thing is that the best title would be Hitler is Coming for Your Guns. But that's not true.
Nope, not even close.
Right.
So first, let's be clear about the argument behind such claims. On the one hand, the purpose is to suggest that guns equal freedom and no guns or the absence of guns equals tyranny. This is, to put it lightly, highly debatable at best as a historical question. And which is to say, if you look around the world today, there is no clear correlation one way or the other between sort of rates of gun ownership and level of freedom as measured by, for example, Freedom House. So there's that part of it. And the other part of it is, in a related sense, to make this argument that, you know, the first thing Hitler did was to take away people's guns. It is to make what has been called a reductio ad Hitlerum.
What now?
Reductio ad Hitlerum. In other words, literally a reduction to Hitler. And you've seen this in other cases.
You just made that up.
I did not. I wish I'd made that up. Dude, I wish I had made that up. No. No, it's
reduction
a thing.
Reduction to Hitler, okay.
A reduction to Hitler. So basically, it's any argument in which the argument unfolds like this. Hitler was evil, therefore something or anything that Hitler did was also evil.
Which I'm
hoping is dismissed in the first week of any introductory logic class at the university level. Because by this logic, things like vegetarianism and anti-smoking campaigns and modern superhighways are also all evil, because those are all things that Hitler did. And of course, that's absurd. Those things are not evil inherently.
Yeah. No, of course.
Like anything, they could be put to, vegetarianism could be put to evil uses. But there are highly democratic systems that have strict gun laws, and vice versa. There are dictatorships or authoritarian regimes in which you have loose gun laws.
Right.
So like I said, there's no correlation.
Right. Both historically and now.
To put it another way, to imply that gun control advocates favor tyranny is as insulting as to suggest that gun rights advocates favor violence. And of course, neither of those claims hold up even for a minute.
No.
But apart from offering lessons in logic and fairness, there are problems with this claim.
Mm-hmm.
This is as a historical claim about the Third Reich.
Right.
First of all, it fundamentally misunderstands how Hitler consolidated and held power in Nazi Germany. And this is something we talked about way back when we did that three-part episode on Adolf Hitler. But to put it very simply, the Third Reich was not basically a prison camp with 65 million inmates who were itching to rise up and only did so because they had not been allowed to keep their guns. That sort of picture, which I think some people have in their head, or the more I guess a more basic version, which is it's a state that rules 100% through terror and has no other aspects to it in terms of how it operated and how it ensured its power. Mm-hmm. That is basically completely false.
Right.
Let's remember that Hitler received a plurality of votes in Germany, in pre-Nazi Germany, in free and fair elections, elections that were as fair as any on the planet.
Yeah, so it's 1932. It's not correct to say he seized power. He was elected.
Well, he was appointed, but he was appointed partly because he had a plurality. His party had a plurality of votes.
In that kind of system, yeah.
Right, absolutely. And then after he becomes chancellor and after he consolidates the Nazi dictatorship, by all accounts, he was a hugely popular dictator through the start of World War II.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Obviously, we don't have the equivalent of Gallup poll, but all the historians agree with this and all the evidence points in this direction that Hitler... for various reasons we talked about in that earlier episode, is that he was genuinely popular even among a lot of Germans who did not vote for him in the pre-1933 elections. So now let's not go too far. Obviously, this is a vile police state. It used terror. It relied on the Gestapo and the security police and the SS to basically police Germany. And they had informants and they had torture and they had prisons and they had concentration camps. Right. That's all true. I'm not taking away anything from that. But yeah. They also relied heavily on consent. In other words, they gave they seemed to be bringing Germany back. In the eyes of millions of Germans who were not Nazis, they genuinely deserved popular support.
Right, so that's big point number one. To say this thing about that Hitler, the first thing he did was take away people's gun, fundamentally misunderstands how Hitler came to power and consolidated power.
Right, exactly, and how he sort of that he ruled through consent as well as through coercion.
Right. Well, but what do historians of Nazi Germany say about this? The experts about Nazi Germany now, what do they say?
Well, and that. Right. Well, and that's it's a great question because I think that's another thing we should look at, which is, you know, don't take my word for it. Go and look at any modern history of the Third Reich or any modern biography of Adolf Hitler. You will find either next to nothing or nothing about German gun ownership. And this is from, you know, experts who have devoted their entire careers to studying Adolf Hitler, Nazi Germany, how he came to power, how that state sort of ticked, what made it tick.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
German gun ownership is almost never mentioned in any context because it was not a factor. There are some historians, as we'll see in a minute, who have looked at this narrower question of German gun ownership. But in the big picture, the people who study Nazi Germany and Adolf Hitler, they don't talk about this. And that should strike people as a pretty powerful dog that didn't bark.
Okay, I think that's absolutely a fascinating or a wonderful way to explain it, because it was not a factor, certainly in a general sense. But you're sort of leading to leaning towards explaining why. I mean, we hear that Hitler did disarm at least some Germans, right?
Well, not really. So now I think we should go through this because it is a little complicated, but okay, in big picture, it basically points in the opposite direction. In the opposite direction, this is problem number two, right?
Right,
the first problem is that the misunderstanding of how Hitler and Nazi Germany functioned. Problem number two is that this argument is wrong on the basic facts about German gun laws.
Oh, the basic facts about it. Okay, good.
Right, and so you could argue that this is even more important. That I sort of set the table with problem one, and here's the main course, which is problem two,
yeah.
And that is to say, the background is that the Weimar Republic, okay, so this is the German democracy constructed after World War I and that was destroyed by the Nazis. So the Weimar Republic, right, this 14-year experiment in democracy, it passed a law essentially banning gun ownership in 1919, basically the first year of the Weimar Republic.
Oh, 1919. Okay, so long before Hitler then.
Right. So let's just emphasize this. What the Nazis are accused of doing, the Weimar Republic basically tried to do or intended to do in 1919. And if you're wondering why they did this, they did this partly for stability purposes because post-war Germany was a mess and very violent. They also did it in part to stay in compliance with the Versailles Treaty. But let me just ram the point home here, which is to say, by the logic of this myth, i.e. you take away people's guns and you end up with a dictatorship, you should have had a dictatorship in Germany in 1919.
And you didn't.
Not in 1933. No, you didn't. You had, I mean, it had some basic flaws, but it was, if you look around the world in 1919, the Weimar democracy was a very, very good democracy. It was a very, that had a lot of the rights and a lot of the protections that Americans enjoyed. So then you fast forward to 1928, a little later in the Weimar Republic. They passed a new gun registration law, which replaced the 1919 ban. So it basically eased up a bit on the ban. It basically required permits to own and to sell both guns and ammunition.
Right, okay.
In reality, there was very little compliance because only new purchases were registered. And so Germans who had and kept guns that they had acquired before 1919 pretty much continued to own them. Right, so in other words, they're not going around and requiring you to register a gun you already own. It's only applies to new purchases.
And do we know whether whether World War One German soldiers were allowed to keep their guns, take their rifles?
That's a good question.
Home?
I don't know for sure. I don't think so.
Of Versailles, that, probably.
Right. And I'm don't quote me, but I'm pretty sure that basically you know, and keep in mind you had all these paramilitary units, and a lot of them had, and you know, and they were sort of quasi-official, and a lot of them, including some who associated with the Nazis in Bavaria, a lot of them had access to military bases and their weapons. But your individual returning German soldier, I'm pretty sure, did not take his weapon home with him. Here we're talking about weapons that people owned already. These typically were weapons for hunting. Long guns, either bolt-action rifles or shotguns, and then also in some cases handguns.
Okay, so Professor, you've outlined the two biggest problems with this story. That first thing Hitler did was take away his guns, which to me, you know, sort of eliminates the argument because you showed not only did not happen, but it couldn't have happened, and that the Weimar Republic would have been the dictatorship because that's when it happened, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's almost comprehensive destroying of this myth. But what was it about the Nazis? What did they do to about guns? Did they make any sort of bans or any sort of regulations or change things after 1933?
Right, and here's where we sort of complete the argument, because the Weimar Republic, right, that says what happened. Well, that's the context in which the Nazis came into power. So the Nazis did use the permit files. So in other words, the permit files from the Weimar Republic on new purchases. Those permit files were used to confiscate guns from their enemies, but this was only a fraction of the total number of guns. In other words, they didn't go house to house and search if you had guns and then took them away if you were on the list of their enemies. They were only working from the permit files, which is a tiny fraction of the total number of firearms. So most gun owners, including German Jews, kept their guns into the late 1930s.
Ah, that's very significant.
Yes, because let's just be clear about this. That what that means is that most German gun owners still had their guns during the years when Hitler consolidated his dictatorship. And once again, the implied, if not the stated argument is, if they had been allowed to keep all their guns, they could have prevented the establishment of the dictatorship, or they could have fought back, or Hitler wouldn't have messed with them and their rights, et cetera, et cetera. But so during this year, so this is in the late 30s. Hitler's dictatorship is completely locked down by mid-1934.
Wow.
So for years after that, the vast majority of German gun owners who had their guns before still had them during these years. Now, in 1938, the Nazis passed their so-called Deutsche Waffengesetz, or the German Weapons Act.
Right, right.
And this, and get this, because this is even more interesting. In some ways, this actually loosened gun restrictions.
Oh.
Loosened them. In most ways, this was a loosening of the existing gun restrictions. For example, the restrictions applied only to handguns.
Yeah.
The length of the permit was increased from 1 year to 3 years. So under the previous, the 1928 Weimar law, your permit was only good for a year. The Nazis lengthened that to 3 years, I'm assuming because they didn't want to process as much paperwork.
But, so you mean you could keep the gun longer before having to own up
before,
to it?
Exactly, before having to extend your permit.
Wow, right. So even if they wanted to take things away, they'd have to wait until the permit. Yeah.
And I'm assuming their thinking is, look, if I'm willing to give you this permit for 1 year, I can give it to you for three. They also lowered the purchase age. The minimum age before was 20, and they lower it to 18. So my question is, if in general, if this is a dictatorship that is worried about private gun ownership, why are they 5 years into their existence, why are they loosening some of the basic sort of features of their gun registration laws, right?
Yeah, it just seems to make, you know, you explained it makes no sense sort of logically, but then the historical development from 1919 onwards shows why it didn't happen. But this also shows logically it doesn't make any sense that it would have happened in the 30s.
Right. Or to put it another way, this is a regime that at some level trusts hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of Germans to own firearms, which would also, once again, feeds back into that earlier argument, which is this would suggest that they understand they have a certain level of compliance and consent completely irrespective of gun ownership.
Right. Okay, well, Buzzkillers, we're about 15 minutes into the show, so it's time for us to take a little bit of a break, but we'll be back to hear more from Professor Nash about what becomes an even more complicated, more interesting subject the more you get into it. Back in a minute. Buzzkillers, you know that I'm totally stoked about being sponsored by The Great Courses Plus. They have a fantastic streaming service. You get to learn from actual experts who know how to teach, real professors, people who have spent years of studying their field. And most importantly, friends, they know how to teach and how to engage with people. In particular, related to this episode and related to what I've been studying in order to prep for this episode, is their course, A History of Hitler's Empire, given by Dr. Thomas Childers at the University of Pennsylvania. I'm learning so much about Hitler's empire in German-speaking lands and elsewhere, and I'm learning a lot more about Hitler's foreign policy than I ever knew before, right? In undergraduate school, graduate school, it's teaching me more and more and more. Why? Because Professor Childers is fantastic. With a vast selection of subjects, The Great Courses Plus truly has something for everyone. You can learn how to become a great writer, practice mindfulness, or delve into astrophysics. And now with the Great Courses Plus app, you can learn anywhere, anytime, and it's so easy. I love this streaming service. And I especially want to put a shout out about it to this particular audience I'm targeting today, and that is history teachers in high schools and in secondary schools across the world. It's a great way to deepen your preparation for your classes. And of course, they have classes on all sorts of historical topics and all sorts of other topics. Now is the perfect time to sign up for The Great Courses Plus. My listeners can check out any course for free. That's free access to the entire library to choose one. Okay, this isn't free shipping. This isn't you get an extra 10% off if you're being a good person. This is free. Don't wait any longer. Sign up today using my special URL, thegreatcoursesplus.com/buzzkill. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/buzzkill. And now back to our discussion with Professor Nash. Okay, we're back with Professor Nash on the subject of Hitler is coming for your guns. We left before the break to talk about how not only was this logically not possible, or logically is a myth, and how the history develops and shows as a myth, but, you know, there are occasionally these things that come up as quotes. Didn't Hitler say something like the most foolish mistake we could possibly make would be to allow what he called the subjugated races to possess arms?
Yes, that is actually a real Hitler quote, and this is sometimes cited by people who embrace this argument about Hitler and gun confiscation. This is another, and you talk about this all the time, of course. It's really easy to launch commando raids on history and take quotations that may be narrowly accurate, take them out of context. And this is one of those cases. So this quotation, and by the way, it's from this source. It's called Hitler's Table Talk. In his headquarters during World War II, it's a great source for historian. They were basically note takers who basically recorded his every utterance, not with a tape recorder, but with notes. And so this is from Hitler's Table Talk. This quote, so the most foolish mistake we could possibly make would be to allow the subjugated races to possess arms. That is a quotation from 1942.
All right, and long after he's taken power.
Long after he's taken power. He's referring to conquered and occupied territory in the East. So this is, you know, this is a year or so after the Operation Barbarossa, where the Germans invaded the Soviet Union. So the quote ends, so the rest of the quote is, and I'm quoting, "So let's not have any native militia or native police." So in other words, this was not about civilian populations in general. This was definitely not about the German populace. This was not about Jews in Germany. This was about how do you police the occupied Soviet Union. And there were people who were basically, you know, because Germany is running into a manpower problem. There were people who talked about, well, and by the way, and they there were native militias and auxiliaries and police, and they played a huge role in the Holocaust. But here's Hitler is basically dialing this back and expressing his skepticism about relying on native militia or native police.
Outside of Germany.
Outside of Germany. Non-Jewish Germans, back in Germany, non-Jews, they were allowed to keep their guns. And remember, this is an argument about remaining free from your own government. This is not in the context of foreign occupation. This is an argument about the guns equal freedom. This is how you protect yourself against your own government, which if left to its own devices and if you're unarmed, they'll come and get you, or they will tyrannize you. So that Hitler quote, which is sometimes used, that was uttered in a completely different context.
And we should remind buzzkillers that when we're saying this argument, we're talking about the argument that Hitler, and in fact all dictatorships, totalitarians, the first thing they do is take away people's guns. And Professor Nash is comprehensively showing that it's not only true, but the logic doesn't work. Well, you keep mentioning German Jews and how things might have been somewhat different for them. What was that situation?
Right. And so that was different. And here the Nazis did clamp down, and this was in November 1938. Uh-huh. And not coincidentally, right after Kristallnacht, the infamous Night of Broken Glass, when you had this massive nationwide pogrom against German Jews. It's a very important, we should probably do a show on it. It's a really absolutely important watershed in the development of the Holocaust. This is the first time that Jews were subject to mass arrest and thrown in concentration camps, that despite all the harassment and the other stages of the Holocaust up until this point, that hadn't happened. But this event, Kristallnacht, what the Nazis used to justify this pogrom all across Germany, which included the burning of synagogues, etc., this was triggered by the murder of a low-ranking German diplomat in Paris by a distraught Jewish German. This was a young man, a teenager actually, whose parents had been deported from Germany, but weren't admitted into Poland, and so they were basically languishing in this no man's land on the border, out in the open, with like sort of no prospects. And in his desperation, in his rage, he shot and killed a German diplomat. This was seized upon by the Nazis to justify Kristallnacht. And what they did at the same time is they then decided to confiscate all weapons from Jews. Now, they had been raiding Jewish homes already.
Yeah.
And so this is the Nazis piggybacking on this event, not only to go after Jews in terms of Kristallnacht, but also using this shooting as propaganda to suggest that the Jews posed a threat, and then you go in one step further and confiscate guns from Jews, those Jews who have them, in order to suggest that they posed a threat, right? In other words, because of this event, we have to protect ourselves against the Jews and take away their guns. So, in other words, they don't necessarily worry about Jews having guns. They use the confiscation as a way of suggesting the Jews are a threat, if that makes sense.
No, it does make sense. And again, we should remember the chronology here. We're talking about November 1938.
Right.
Hitler's been in power for 5 years.
Right.
The
war hasn't started yet. But remember, the earlier phases of the Holocaust doesn't include putting people in camps. It doesn't include death camps.
Right.
It's all sorts of harassment. But that harassment and the Nuremberg laws and the book burning and the boycott of Jewish stores, all those things take place. But you do not have a confiscation of the guns of Jews until November 1938. So let's run this experiment. So at this point, let's say the Jews with guns in Germany had risen up. Because this is a sort of a side, sort of practical issue. So how would that have gone? So we're talking about the roughly 400,000 remaining, because a lot of Jews had emigrated by this point. But let's say roughly 400,000 Jews in Germany and Austria. Remember, Austria, the Anschluss has taken place. Austria has been absorbed into Germany. including its, I believe it's around 200,000 Jews initially. So we're talking about a population of 400,000 or so Jews, only some of whom own guns, in a country of 75 million people. So, I mean, obviously we don't know how that would have gone down. But once again, the suggestion is that if you're armed, you can rise up and protect yourself. I'm thinking that if you just look at the numbers, and I don't have it at the ready what percentage of German Jews own guns. I suspect it's a minority. Yeah. But it's certainly a minority, or maybe even, let's say it's a large minority of those 400,000. That's in a country of 75 million people going up against the police state, the SS, the army, the regular police, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think that would have gone very well. Mm-hmm. But I have a quotation here from one of the leading historians of Nazi Germany and the Third Reich. His name is Omer Bartov. And he wrote, and I'm quoting, "Just imagine the Jews of Germany exercising their right to bear arms and fighting the SA, the SS, and the Wehrmacht. The Red Army lost 7 million men fighting the Wehrmacht despite its tanks and planes and artillery. The Jews with pistols and shotguns would have done better," end quote, which I think is another it's another dimension to this, which I don't think sort of solves the argument, but I think it's another interesting aspect to it.
And you know, I think that bears repeating, though. Can you say that again? I mean, you're right. There are 400,000 Jews left. If half of them, 200,000, have guns, they couldn't outdo what the Red Army with all of its
The Red Army, which outnumbered the Wehrmacht. Yeah. So I'll give you the quotation again.
Yeah, I just think it's important for the buzzkill. This is the thing we should really pound into people's heads who might still believe this.
Right. So here's the quotation. Omer Bartov, historian, quote, "Just imagine the Jews of Germany exercising their right to bear arms and fighting the SA, those are the brown shirts, parenthetically.
Yeah.
The SS and the Wehrmacht. The Red Army lost 7 million men fighting the Wehrmacht despite its tanks and planes and artillery. The Jews with pistols and shotguns would have done better."
Yeah, and civilians, and untrained.
Right, exactly. Yeah, you probably would have had maybe a few World War I veterans, but they would have been older. And all right, exactly. We're talking about civilians.
Yeah, if the Soviet Army couldn't do it, a crowd of civilians.
Well, they could do it, but it took them years.
Oh, it took a very long time. Yeah,
and it took a long time, and it was this epic struggle on the Eastern Front. And I would add, by the way, had the Jews, or even some Jews, risen up with their guns, I believe that sort of move would have strengthened the support of German Gentiles for the Nazi regime and then for the Holocaust, right?
Oh.
This would have confirmed in their eyes, oh, see, look, the Jews are a threat. This would have played right into the hands of Nazi propaganda, is what I'm saying.
Ah, okay. So it'd be almost like the Kristallnacht thing again. The murder of the diplomat, this would be on an even larger scale. So now we really have to sweep in and put the Holocaust into even higher gear.
That's right. Right. For example, for those Germans who might have believed for whatever reason that the Jews didn't constitute quite the threat that the Nazis suggested they did, this would convince a lot of those people.
But in Warsaw, in occupied Poland, armed Jews did rise up, right?
Yes, they did. This you're referring to the famous Warsaw Ghetto Uprising of April, May 1943. Very famous event in the history of the Holocaust and an important event. It is sometimes cited by gun rights supporters.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
First, let me say that I'm taking nothing away from those hundreds of Warsaw Jews who rose up. It was an incredibly brave act. It had enormous symbolic importance in the history of the Holocaust. But let's also keep this in perspective, keep it in context. The Jews who rose up suffered enormous losses. Only a tiny minority of them survived. They inflicted, the numbers vary, but they inflicted relatively few casualties on the Germans. And perhaps most importantly of all, they did not interrupt the Holocaust at all. This, in the larger scheme of the Germans or the pace of the Nazis' killing machine, this did not make a difference. And I don't think there's any historian of the Holocaust who argues that.
So let's take this, but then get to your bottom line. Hitler is coming for your guns.
Right. My bottom line, I've said this before in other shows, in other contexts, it's worth repeating. Everything we have just said is not about the merits of contemporary debate. In this case,
yes, that's right.
Gun control versus gun rights. This argument is a legitimate argument that should be argued on its merits. and should not rely on the invocation of false historical analogies. Massive confiscation of guns was not the first thing Hitler did, and it was not the last thing Hitler did. Overall, he loosened, rather than tightened, he loosened gun laws for most Germans, and only confiscated guns from German Jews in late 1938, 5 years into the history of the regime. Gun control was neither instrumental in establishing nor in preserving the Nazi dictatorship, nor was it instrumental in the history of the Holocaust.
Well, Professor, I can't think of a more comprehensive way to address this myth and this use of political rhetoric in an attempt to try to talk about a contemporary debate by using, as you say, false historical analogies.
Right. So, yeah, there are all sorts of problems with this argument.
Again, we have to stress, though, because we do like people to contact us about the show. So, especially with this topic, hatemail@professorbuzzkill.com gets to us, as does info@professorbuzzkill.com. We set up the special hate mail email address for exactly such occasions, because these seem to be the shows where people really start the passions start to fly. And it just remains for me to thank you, Professor, for coming on the show again.
My pleasure. Always a pleasure.
And to say, you buzzkillers out there, that we will talk to you next week.